This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us as we begin this hour of the show. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls. In this part of the program, we'll be talking with Courtney Flint. She is a rural sociologist here at the University of Illinois. She's a professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences. And we will be talking about some of the work that she has done, and she's worked in different areas of the country. But one thing that she's particularly interested in is how people in rural communities deal with environmental change. Sometimes it's things that maybe can sneak up on you a little bit. On the other hand, it can be something that happens very quickly and can be very difficult and very devastating. We'll talk about some of her work, and probably the easiest thing to get into the subject is to give some concrete examples right away so we're not talking really vague. And as we talk, of course, questions and comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As we go along here, if you're interested in joining the conversation, callers are certainly welcome. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks very much for having me.
And I guess maybe the sort of the underlying thing is here, as I think that probably we are more and more aware of environmental change, how it impinges on the way people live. It's certainly not anything that is particularly new, but it's somehow it seems that the pace of it is growing, and that for that reason, then, particularly people in rural areas, it's something that they've got to pay attention to. Maybe some because they live closely to the land, because it's tied very closely to their livelihoods, agriculture and forestry and tourism and so forth. Is that in fact true, do you think?
I think it is true. I think that one of the issues we have, though, is that environmental change, or if we're talking about climate change, these things come at us fast and furiously. They're in the media. They seem to be this pressing concern, and indeed they can be in people's lives. But they're a bit abstract. You know, it's hard to know what we actually mean by environmental change or climate change or things like that. But for people who live and work and play in and around a natural environment, so perhaps people who are in smaller communities, kind of on the edge of natural environments, it's more immediate, perhaps, in these kinds of settings. And so what tends to be more abstract in the media has some real-world implications for people who are in that kind of interface.
Yeah.
And so it is something that people have to deal with on a daily basis. And again, I think one of the things you mentioned was sometimes environmental changes they're slow and you don't even realize that they're happening. At other times, they just kind of hit you in the face, you know, severe weather or something like that. And so there are a lot of different ways in which people have to deal with and cope with environmental change.
Yeah. Well, just as a way of having something to talk about, something concrete, let's give an example. And here this is a case where it's something that you've done a lot of work in a particular part of Alaska, and that to us here in the Midwest, that seems like a long way away. But you're talking about something that in a very direct way affected the lives of the folks living there. This is in the Kenai Peninsula, and it has to do with an increasing problem with an insect that
right.
attacks a kind of tree that's a very important part of the ecosystem there.
That's right. On the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska, they have been dealing for, 25 years with a spruce bark beetle that is a natural part of the environment, natural part of the forest ecosystem there. But it has really exploded over the last few years. In fact, it's a bit on the decline now. But in the 80s and the 90s and early 2000, these beetles were just munching their way through the trees of the Kenai Peninsula. About 1.5 million acres of trees was just presented just a smorgasbord for those beetles. And they came out. And really, the situation that the foresters and the entomologists, the people who study these beetles, have said is that the combination of an old forest that really hadn't been harvested, just as an old forest, and then some rapidly changing climates. You know, the summers were getting drier and warmer. Winters weren't as cold. And it kind of created an environment where these beetles could really take off. So what we did in conjunction with the Forest Service was we went to look at the different communities that live that are people who live on the Kenai Peninsula, and to figure out how communities were responding to these dramatic changes, because it was about 80 to 90% of the trees in these forests were dying, were being killed, all the way down to the small diameter trees. Mm-hmm. The Forest Service was frustrated by the fact that these communities were just didn't seem to be responding the way they anticipated they would. Forest Service thought that this was simply a fire issue and that communities really ought to be doing a lot of harvesting, really cutting some trees because these dead trees were going to pose a serious fire risk. What we found is that so there was this broader context of climate change, right? But what was immediately felt by the people living on the Kenai Peninsula was their trees were dying. And it was certainly a fire issue, but it was so much more. You know, the forests were the backdrop for their whole lives. You know, their identity, their attachments to their place were really tied to these trees. So there was a grieving process that people went through. So it wasn't in any way abstract. It was very immediate. But different communities reacted in very, very different ways. Different communities have different characteristics. Different personalities almost. And we found a lot of differences.
Yeah. So it certainly was a fire danger. That was a particular issue. But also this is a place where tourism is very important. So the loss of the trees was very important there. And for people who live there and are very attached to the place, as you say, that's a significant loss. So it wasn't that they didn't think that there was something really serious going on, but that everybody had some sort of a different idea. People said, well, yes, we ought to clear that away. Or some people said, well, this is just kind of part of the cycle of things, and maybe they're not so concerned about that. I suppose the big challenge is that if you were trying to craft some kind of a policy, how you get everybody on board if people in one community have one idea about how you should deal with the issue, and then you go to another community and most of the people there have a completely different or significantly different idea. How do you go about getting everybody together and coming up with some kind of a plan that everybody can agree to?
Yeah, I think that's always the issue. What happened on the Kenai Peninsula is what they tried to do was pull people from a number of these different communities together to create sort of an action plan for how to deal with this. And they really made it a consensus process. They wanted to bring two people together, figure out what they could all agree on, and work from that and develop some plans. Sounds logical, right? What happened was that these people, there wasn't very much that these people could agree on. So when you reduce everything down to what you can get consensus on, sometimes you're not left with very much. So the action plan was very specific, very focused, you know, clear the trees around the power lines. Well, people could agree on that, a few things kind of like that. I think what this kind of research is showing is that we shouldn't be afraid of the conflict, and we shouldn't be afraid to deal with those messy or those wicked problems and avoid things that you can't get consensus on. I think what we discovered was bringing people together to talk about these issues, even if they didn't agree. You know, one community really wants to let nature run its course. Another community wants to cut all the trees down and replant and really have a production forest. When you bring those people together to talk and work together over time, they find that they do have things in common, that they share this place that they all care a lot about. And so maybe there's not some ultimate outcome that's the perfect solution, but this process of talking and having a dialogue to work with the land managers on trying to come up with some solutions and at least a process was a good way to go.
Yeah. Now, I can imagine, though, that sort of process of trying to get people together to talk and to talk long enough so that they finally get to the point where they realize there are a lot of things they can agree on and come to some kind of plan that everybody can sign on to. I can imagine that could take some time. While everybody's trying to work out their differences, the problem that they're trying to address continues to go. So I suppose either you have to have something to get to move that process along if you can, or you've got to start earlier. You've got to, in a sense, recognize when you have a problem and say, we really need to start talking about this now, not next week or next month or next year.
Right. Anticipating the kinds of anticipating environmental change is not an easy thing. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. There are a lot of risks and things that can be measured and can be anticipated, and we certainly need to bring those things to the forefront. It is tough to get people to the table to talk to each other and to work with managers. The way we manage natural resources isn't necessarily always based on this participatory, get people to talk together kind of process. When it is, it tends to be quite effective. In Alaska, it was difficult to do this, to get people together, not the least of which some of these communities don't really have the capacity. You know, they're not active, you know, interacting sorts of communities. People kind of live their own lives and they stick to themselves. It's kind of the Alaska mentality. Mm-hmm. So trying to bring people out to have all these conversations, that wasn't particularly easy. Some communities just don't have what we call the interactional capacity to even sort of get to the table on a larger scale issue. Others are oozing with capacity, and they are constantly, you know, in the process of having dialogue and public kinds of battles over things or working together, whatever. And so the issue is it's easy to work with those communities that already know how to be part of the process. A lot of the times the communities that are perhaps more at risk and really do need to be a part of the process don't have that collective power to raise their hands and say, hey, we want to be at the table. They don't even know how to do that, really. They don't have that experience. So we need a process that is inclusive and representative of the multiple perspectives across a changing landscape. But it does happen, and when it does, it's really great. But as you say, it takes time. One of the things that happened on the Kenai Peninsula is as these beetles were working their way through the forest, people were coping with this grieving process and trying to figure out how to deal with change on their own land and across the landscape. Time passed, and what we're doing now is we're going back to these communities to see how their perspectives have changed. And they've had some fires, in fact, pretty large fires on the Kenai Peninsula. How has this changed their risk perceptions? How has it changed their attitudes about the forest? What we found is that in 4 or 5 years, the spruce bark beetle is really not an issue anymore. It went from being a critical issue, everyone's so emotional about it, to being, oh, yeah, well, we just kind of got used to these gray trees. And, oh, look, there's a lot of little trees growing on up. And it's just nature running its course. And so now it's a very different setting for managing natural resources because there's a dynamic process. You know, you can, if you study communities at one point in time, you only get really that one point in time. It's the importance of continuing to work with communities over time because they'll change just as the environments will change too.
Well, do you find then when you go back that those people who were in the let nature run its course camp are saying, you see, we were right, and that maybe now some people are saying, well, maybe they were right.
You know, I think what's happening is that a lot of people think they were right because you'll have some people, just as you said, you know, let Mother Nature do her thing and it'll all be okay. They're feeling pretty good. On the other hand, you've got areas that were logged, areas that were clear. And you'll have people who say, see what a great fire break we now have. Or they'll say, man, look at the berries that are growing up in this area. Now we've opened it up. We have more wildlife. Boy, we were right. And making some changes to the landscape and being proactive really was beneficial. So really, I think it's sort of a win-win situation. The landscape has certainly changed. The climate is changing there, and people really talk about it on a daily basis. And communities have gone ahead and adapted and adjusted and responded and changed along with it. It's an ongoing process.
Yeah. It's true if you look back through human history that human beings have modified the landscape to the extent that they can, you know, and we've been doing this forever. So you have to wonder just how much nature, unassisted by human beings, does its thing anywhere. But you know, having said that, I guess, you know, when we are talking about significant in natural, you know, sort of shocking natural acts, or even the things that sort of sneak up on you, like things that are related to climate change, where you do sort of draw that line between saying nature does follow certain courses, things do go in cycle, and that it doesn't have a whole lot to do with us, and there's really not much we can do about it, between, you know, taking that line and saying that, well, in fact, there are things that we can do to modify what's going on at least in the sense that we can mitigate potential damage and negative consequences. And it seems to me that that must be sort of a difficult course to steer.
It is. I think one of the things we've seen happen is in managing natural resources, managing ecosystems, there's been a real sort of shift, a paradigm shift, if you will, a real different perspective. We used to manage natural resources as if disturbances were really negative. So things like fires or insect outbreaks or, you know, events in forests or in other kinds of ecosystems and landscapes. But disturbance was not necessarily a good thing and that those were to be controlled. Mm-hmm. Management has really shifted to much more of a value neutral kind of stance on disturbances, more of an ecological approach that changes part of the natural ecosystem. And so it either needs to be allowed to just occur naturally or perhaps we need to manage to include disturbances. Maybe we need to create some disturbances to really create a natural environment. So this shift to more of a value-neutral management approach is one thing. But, you know, disturbances are rarely value-neutral mm-hmm. to people and to communities who are experiencing them. They're usually very value-laden and usually multiple values in competition. So there are winners and losers. People are, you know, their lives can be changed by these kinds of disturbances, whether they're slow like a beetle outbreak or they're really rapid and fast like some, like a wildfire. So that's a real clash then between those value neutral kinds of management approaches and these very value laden reactions in human communities.
Very quickly, let me just introduce again our guest, Courtney Flint. She's professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at the U of I. She's a rural sociologist by her training and has done work a lot of different places around the United States where people are responding to different kind of challenges, but all of, in one way or another, she's interested in how rural communities and rural parts of the countries are dealing with environmental change. And when things come along that really change the ecology of their area in ways that affect their livelihood and the way that they live and the way that they're attached to the land. And just one as one example, we talked a little bit about some of the work that she's done in Alaska. Questions, comments, certainly welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. So you've actually, in your work, you have really done work in communities all over the place, in Alaska, in Colorado, in Southern Illinois, in Louisiana, in a lot of very different places in different places of the country.
We have, and it's one of the best things about my work is getting out and working with real people in real places. I must say that's my favorite part of my job. And really, I think what I'm trying to do with sort of over my career is to really build up instead of just approaching communities as cases, looking in depth and have one case study after another. It's trying to build a sense of how do communities respond to change, appreciating that they may respond very differently under different circumstances. And so looking at communities in different regions across the country that are experiencing environmental change differently, mm-hmm. to see what rises to the top, what are some of the themes that we see repeated, and what are those things that are just simply very different from one region to another. And that's been really fun to see. Doing similar work in Colorado to the work I did with the communities and the bark beetles in Alaska, you know, working in Colorado, where we've got very high-end resort communities like Vail and Breckenridge, all the way to very rural, agriculturally based and very open rural settings like Jackson County or Walden in northern Colorado and communities in between. And that creates a whole kind of a different setting, really, where you've got this gradient of communities from this high end to really economically disadvantaged communities. And some things we're finding to be really quite similar. And, you know, people come together, they work together. You know, in some ways, it doesn't really matter about that sort of economic setting that communities are in. In other ways, it matters a great deal, has a lot to do with attitudes about the natural environment, and really affects who comes to the table, what they come with. Do they come with a chip on their shoulder? Do they, How do they feel about each other? So it's fun. It's really fun to work with different communities. Mm. And moving to Illinois and doing some work with communities in southern Illinois also, not necessarily on beetle issues or anything like that, but in dealing with regional change and agricultural issues and how communities are coping with the threats and opportunities that they face is yet again a way to sort of stretch some of these issues to see what commonalities there are and what differences. And it's an ongoing process.
We have a caller, a couple of callers. First person is on the cell phone. We'll just get right to them. They're line number one. We'll go there right here. Hello.
Okay, I'm coming in late to the discussion, so just go ahead and skip over if I'm touching on old ground. But something that's striking about the present administration in Washington is that although they've really tried to bury lots of information about climate change, from what I've read, it seems they've studied it more than any previous administration, and they have apparently gathered lots of information. And I wonder if this information, if you have access to it, if you know anything about it, if it is predictions for what's going to happen in various regions. And I had another question, sort of related but not really. Do you see attitude changes, and you probably already covered this, of people when their area gets hit? Do they all of a sudden say, wow, we used to look at these things as being, you know, political and be hostile to innovations because we felt they were foisted on us for no good reason by people who thought they knew better than us, and then see some revolutionary change? Or is it some totally different dynamic? I suspect you've talked about that, but if you haven't, I'd like to hear about it. Thanks.
Okay.
I think I'll tackle the second question first. I really think that there's a lot to talk about in terms of the political aspects of what's going on. And while I don't deal with the policy realm at a large scale, there's no doubt that people who are living, working, and being in places that are undergoing change, they're tuned into what's going on politically. So it comes up a lot. What we have found in Alaska in particular is that this climate change and environmental change and the disturbances in their forests were very real. And they were not necessarily, a lot of people would be real hesitant to say, oh, this is part of global warming or global climate change, because that was politically loaded. But they would very readily say, our climate is changing. Our situation is very real, and we need to address this. They wanted to separate their local issues from the global or national scale politics because they were uncomfortable in that realm. And that was cutting across all different angles, political angles. So people are willing to talk about change when it's happening right there and they can experience it on a daily basis. They have a hard time connecting it sometimes to the more abstract kind of global concept of climate change. And so people, they feel more uncertain about those kinds of things in some cases. In terms of the federal government and the whole issue of climate change, it's not really my area of expertise, and I tend to not follow that too closely. I tend to work more with the communities that are dealing with things on an everyday basis. But I think it's quite clear that the research is definitely showing climatic fluctuations, and there's an ability to predict environmental change. Now, maybe not the specific nature of the change, but the change is really inevitable. But it's in local places where these experiences, where these changes will be experienced and have to be dealt with. And I find local people are willing to put aside the politics to deal with the things that are staring them in the face.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that it is true that there might have been places where previously people weren't convinced that there was a problem, that climate was changing, but once they saw it happen in their backyard, at least then they were willing to say, well, I don't know about the rest of the world, but I know what's happening right here. And we're in fact willing to say, yes, I do believe something's happening here. I can see it. It's right here.
That's definitely what was happening in Alaska. And we're finding similar responses in Colorado as well. And it comes up with talking with farmers in southern Illinois as well. And they getting into the sort of national politics is uncomfortable ground for a lot of people, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, we tend to think people have an opinion and they're very willing to speak it. When we get out and we work with people, we find that's an uncomfortable realm for people to deal with, actually. They don't really want to talk about it too much, but they do want to talk about their own place and how it's changing. And then they sometimes do make connections back to some of the larger scales. But I think it really tells us something about our policies, our federal policies, how we're going to deal with climate change, is we've got to get back to the local scale, the regional scale, the landscape scale, where the changes are going to be felt on a day-to-day, year-to-year basis, and where the decisions and the responses are going to have to happen. The thing is that policies tend to be made at different scales. They tend to come from down from above kind of thing. And so there's a disconnect between the level of experience and the level of policy. And I think if we can do it, if there's one recommendation to make from this kind of research, is that one size doesn't fit all. Communities, regions, different landscapes, they're very different. You know, Alaska and Southern Illinois, man, a lot of different issues, lots of different communities that have different kind of vulnerabilities in some cases and different capacities and opportunities. And our policies need to be flexible enough to deal with these different contexts. Yeah. I think that's clear.
Well, it's really interesting because I guess, as you say, what that says is that if you're trying to engage people on the issue of global climate change, that what you really have to do is to it has to become obvious to them that it affects them locally, that it can't maybe it's just too much in the bigger frame. But if it gets down to the point where it's really obvious to you that it affects climate in your region or where you live, and particularly if then that connects to your livelihood, then that's going to get people's attention, because it's no longer something that's abstract then it's something that's real, concrete.
That's right. And I think this gets back to the fact that, you know, people get their information in very different ways. You know, some people get their information from the media, you know, some will get it from more scientific or technical sources or from industry or what have you. There's many different sources. But I think what we're discovering in very rural places is that people get their information from direct observation. You know, they look at the water levels. They look at the quality of the soil. They look at what's happening in the trees. And so they're getting their information in a very different way than perhaps some of us who might live in a more urban setting or just might sort of be removed from that changing environment. That affects decisions. That affects what people are going to do and how they're going to develop their attitudes about things. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. The other thing is that we look to the scientific community for a lot of our information on things like climate change and what will the impacts be. But I think there's a role to play for these local people who are out there directly observing on a daily basis changes in their environment. And there are some really great examples of how local volunteer monitors of environmental issues and change, whether it's water quality or species distribution, population, that kind of information can really feed back into a really thorough understanding of how environments are changing. So that requires a real change in how we approach environmental management.
Let's talk with someone in Atlanta, Illinois, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Morning. Great topic, and I've got a local question and a national question. Both the local question is on our farm in Logan County. It's kind of an oasis part of Logan County, which is mostly agriculture, and there's a marine area here that's got hills and creeks and kind of things that are different from Logan County. So about a mile of our creek has been dedicated as an official nature preserve, which is fine. And I think there's about 80 acres or something like that that encompasses this mile along the creek. And now, with as a cost share project that's funded by the Fish and Wildlife Service called LIP, actually it's administered by the state, we're doing a lot of invasive removal of invasive plants that are along the creek. And, you know, a lot of these are maple trees, which don't belong there, and Osage orange, and other trees that are prohibiting the growth of the oak understory that should be there. And, you know, you know, we had lots and lots of meetings and discussions like you talked about. You know, I've lived here for a long time, and, you know, the woods look fine to me with the maple trees in it or whatever, although, you know, the oaks were predominant as far as size particularly. And, you know, it took a lot of discussion about this is going to promote more native species to, you know, come back and inhabit these things, particularly in birds, which is really what this whole nature preserve is all about, is the creek quality and the bird population, that this is kind of the only resting area in Lone County for birds, or one of the only areas, not only this farm, but this whole moraine area. So right now, today, I think we're finishing up one section of doing this clearing, and I have to admit, it looks tremendously better, but have I really, my idea is, yeah, we are going to make it more friendly to certain species, but where the other species was, there were plant animals that were there unnaturally because it's changed over the years, was that bad or good? And I really never thought about that till this conversation got started. So the question is, what is your take on that? And then my national question is, I know in Montana, clear-cutting, giant swaths of timber have been clear-cut in Montana, and it's actually changed. The timber was actually part of the climate structure, and now the climate has changed in those areas, and it can never come back to the way it was because now it's a whole different ecosystem. And you know, listening to your take on, you know, fire maybe could have done that same thing, but I think the clear cutting probably hastened that change, where a lot of species in the creeks, I mean fish and mammals and everything else, were threatened a lot quicker, and there wasn't a chance of environmental or evolutionary adjustment to have taken place, like maybe if it was a natural way of clear-cutting everything. But the conversation has been really interesting because I'm getting a whole new take. I've been probably thinking about things pretty wrong, so I'll shut up.
Well, really interesting questions, and I think they're actually really connected, because I think this comes down to what are we changing from and what are we changing to, and what do we consider natural? You know, and we're going to, like, you have a very different sense of what the natural environment is, you know, than someone who's advocating a return to an oak forest, you know, and it what's natural to you was probably this, you know, the maple, you know, beech maple kind of forest or whatever that you had grown to be comfortable with. And the bird species that might follow along with that. And do we go backwards? What are we going backwards to? Are we trying to recreate some natural setting that once was? Or are we're obviously moving towards changing to something new. And how can we control that? How can we be involved in what that looks like? And what should it look like? And I think that some of the best models have actually been forward-looking without losing sight of what landscapes have looked like in the past, but looking towards, you know, what do we want the next forest to look like? What do we want this nature preserve to look like in the future? How does it best fit the sort of the whole sort of natural setting here, the species, the vegetation? What do we want that to look like? Maybe it's a bit of what it looked like in the past, but maybe it's carved out to be something new. Montana is my home state, and that's where I'm from, so I'm very familiar with these big swaths of clear-cut mountainsides and the changes that's brought to the natural environment. It's really clear that we've learned a lot of lessons from the way we've managed natural landscapes in the past, and there are a lot of uncertainties about what those. Well, there's some things we know that have been impacts of those modifications of the environment, and other things we may not yet know for many years. We also don't quite know what the future environmental change is going to look like, but we have to do some anticipating, and we've got to pull together all these diverse perspectives, people like you and people who are involved in the timber industry, people who are involved in species management and natural resource management, get everybody to the table, because I think we have to be a little bit proactive. We can't anticipate everything, but we need to think about how we want to manage these resources in the future. You raise a lot of interesting points. You know, what is native? What is invasive? How do we define those kinds of things? These are issues with changing, perhaps some changing climates, changing environmental parameters to certain ecosystems. There are going to be some changes. Being proactive and working together is probably a good way to go about it.
Yeah, in my lifetime, things have changed. I know at one time my dad was a biologist, and burning timber was a terrible thing to burn timber as far as destroying the understory and the habitat that was going to destroy. And now, that's one of the most important timber management as far as an ecology is concerned, at least from the point of view of modern biologists, is to burn timber to get rid of the invasive species and to keep it opened up. So, I mean, this just exactly like you said, this whole theory of management has changed so much in really a relatively short time. It really is complicated, and my position as the landowner to really try, what I really want to do is not to please myself, because I'm not going to be here very long relative to time, but I would like to pass on something that really is the right thing to do, and it's an unbelievably difficult question.
Well, you're right. I wish you a lot of luck.
Thanks for the conversation.
Sure thing.
Bye.
We will continue to talk with another caller in a moment. Let me just again quickly introduce the guest for anyone who might have tuned in. Courtney Flint is professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences at University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign. She's a rural sociologist who's in her work interested in how rural communities deal with environmental change, ecosystem disturbance, and the kinds of changes that come with them. And she has done research in a lot of different places. We talked a little bit about some that she'd done in Alaska. She's also worked in Colorado and in Louisiana and in southern Illinois and a lot of different places, all basically, though, with this kind of central interest. Questions, comments, welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And here's someone in Urbana to talk with. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
You really have touched on a provocative subject and a very interesting one. I was a volunteer steward at Lotus Cemetery Prairie in north of us. It was an unplowed. It's an unplowed area of about 3 1/3 acres that has probably as many as 130 species of original plants. And I was involved in the first decade, I would say, of more or less of pretty intense work to clear out things that were obviously problems, like a lot of mulberries and things in the fence rows, and getting rid of the fence. But over years, it struck me and some others that we've really got to move away from this romance of returning to an original state of nature. And what I mean by that is the situation is pretty well stated, I think, by the book called The Columbian Exchange, whose author's name escapes me at the moment. But he was talking about the fact that when Europeans landed and when Columbus landed and subsequently, enormous changes were made over decades and centuries. There's no original to get back to. And it also reminded me of, in the midst of trying to get exotic species out of this prairies, out of this little prairie patch, I mean, if you can't tweak out every foreign element from 3 1/3 acres, what can you hope to do with 300 or 3,000? The quotation occurred to me, that you can't step into the same river twice. And even that is a bit illusory because you don't have a shore to stand on to step into. You're in the middle of this flux. And that's to get back to my original comment. I think without devaluing the environmental movement at all, or discouraging, entertaining all reasonable and possible points of view, we really have to move from what I call the romance of returning to an original state of nature. In a sense, we're in nature, and we've got the same dilemma generally that we have at Lotus Cemetery Prairie. We don't have documentation. We don't have photography that goes back 100 years. We don't know what even know what was there. And so I just invite your comment to that.
Oh, that's interesting. An interesting experience you've been involved in. And I think you know then firsthand there's not a whole lot of romanticism about, you know, getting out in there and digging up invasive species and hauling them out and dealing with them.
Oh, yes, there is. We're gardeners.
All right. All right.
Especially when you've only got 3 acres. You know,
yeah, well, that, what is, it I does sound, it's a combination
like.
Of fun and hard work, I guess. I think the idea that one of the things you brought up is change is nothing new. You know, environments, landscapes have been, they've always been changing. And for a long time, people have had been a part of that change. And so landscapes and environments are going to continue to change, and people are likely to continue to be involved in the directions. And I think that the best we can do is to work together on those changes so that the people who are affected all have a place at the table. And then, to be prepared for some of the changes that are harshest. But I think a forward-looking approach is probably good. Now, that doesn't mean that we can't look back to what some of these environments, some of these prairies did look like 100, 200 years ago. And we do have some scientific techniques to figure out what those prairies were like. And there may be some real value into bringing some of that along with us as we move forward and incorporate other ideas of landscape management. The key is figuring out, you know, what are people most concerned about? And what are the environmental issues and threats that are important for the sort of ongoing well-being of the ecosystem of which people are only just a part? So I wish you luck with your prairie work, and for all the private landowners out there, they feel the same way. They're operating as little islands. They want to do the best for the land that they own. And they don't particularly want to be an island. So I think reaching out to other people across landscapes and across rural areas so that we can make decisions jointly and have conversations about this, then we can link up these little islands and bridge these kinds of fragmented approaches to dealing with environmental disturbance.
Now, I don't want to be a contrarian, but I'll offer two remarks. First of all, I'm a fond student of history, and I wouldn't, again, I think it's important to our culture that we remember things and interpret them and think about them. But as I've often said to my friends, you know, I read incessantly. I mostly read history. It's my favorite form of fiction. And the other point is that think about the number of times in our conversation about the environment that we necessarily speak of people. We're the dominant, and as I said, I don't want to come across as an obstinate contrarian, but the point is that the environmental crisis is our problem. And what we tend to do what termites and bees do. We colonize and construct thoroughly the architecture that we need, you know, to survive and so on. And this discussion of the environment, which finches and badgers and squirrels can't have with each other, is a human conversation, and we're the origin of the crisis, the species that are going extinct. And again, you can't be romantic about it. We've had extinctions beyond our conception in the geologic past, but on this occasion, it's not a comet crashing into the globe or some vast global change in oceanic circulation that's causing the crisis. It's us. So, thanks. Yeah. This is really an interesting talk.
Thanks for the comment. We're coming down to the point here. We have maybe about 5 minutes. I guess knowing that that's really not a whole lot of time, one of the points I think maybe we might talk a little bit about here to end is that some of the things we're talking, the fact that communities dealing with some of the changes that we're talking about, in some cases, we're not just talking about people having to adjust the way they live. I suppose there are places where you're talking about the question of the survival of the community, whether there's going to be a community or not.
Well, I think that that's true. I think that some of these changes, we don't have the luxury of time to anticipate and plan for. Some kinds of changes come really abruptly, you know, and there can be, well, and these are severe weather, for example, flooding, things like that, that really threaten the well-being of communities. You know, they can indeed wipe communities off the map. You know, wildfire in some of the mountain communities I've worked with, you know, they threaten the very existence of some communities, or not necessarily of if the communities are the people and in the place in which they live and operate, it may sort of survive, but the built environment may severely struggle. It's true that we don't have the luxury of a great deal of insight into the crystal ball to see what's coming down the pike. And as I think I said before, the best we can do is be prepared, especially for some of those harshest events that might come our way. And we think about rural communities, we're talking about some vulnerabilities. You know, there are some burdens that are borne by some rural communities. You know, it's been the process in terms of, I think about my work in terms of disaster management. You know, the federal government, a lot of the responsibilities for preparing and responding to disasters that might or might not come as a result of environmental change. But a lot of that responsibility has come down to the local scale to be first responders and to take care of people in the event that things go seriously wrong and that change happens abruptly. In our work with the community emergency response teams across Illinois, we were looking at this very question. You know, the environmental changes that come fast, how do you prepare for them? And rural communities had a very different approach. They're quite self-reliant, you know, based on perhaps volunteer emergency services, people getting out their old sheets to use as bandages in preparation for events or a tornado, or, you know, using equipment, farm equipment that they might have around to move debris, that sort of thing. Very different from the urban setting where local residents saw themselves as playing much more of a backseat role to the official emergency providers. In rural communities, there's some innovation that's been occurring in certain places, and it's been going on for a long time. People make and do with what they have. And I think that whether you're talking about a very rapid change, a very severe kind of crisis that comes from the combination of social vulnerabilities with environmental changes, this trying to prepare for this can take many different forms. We can use some of the same philosophies of how to respond to and prepare for real crisis disasters and come back to that environmental management on a longer time frame. You know, we can be innovative. We can be a bit self-reliant. If we work together and find those things that we share in common, you know, the appreciation for the prairie, appreciation for the forests around us, if we kind of find those common things about the environment that link us together, we can make ourselves and our communities a bit more prepared to deal with the changes that come our way.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that we could at least touch on this, which is a different area of sort of related, but a kind of different area of work. That is this idea of, you know, how particularly in rural areas, you respond to those kinds of those flash disasters, the hurricane, the tornado, the, you know, whatever it is that comes and hits where you may not expect it, hits very hard, and then you have to deal with the consequences. And as you say, in rural communities, people may be in a circumstance where they may not be able to rely on outside help, at least not right away, and they're going to have to deal with that. And in some places, they're probably better organized to do that than other places. Can one take some kind of lessons from looking at the way that rural communities have, you know, the kinds of ways that they do organize to deal with that? Can you take lessons and apply them to larger communities?
I think you can. I think that what we can learn from that is that we we shouldn't expect all of the kind of action and forward moving progress, trying to be prepared and so forth, to come from only those people and communities with a lot of resources. Really, there is a capacity for action that can happen out of what seemingly pretty depressed or vulnerable conditions. And so I think that's really an important message. The other thing is it is a lot easier to prepare yourself and respond to change if you have resources, you know. But that doesn't necessarily also, like in urban areas, they may have grant writers getting funds. They may have an extensive emergency management system in place. They may have a bureaucracy built up around how to cope with things. And in those settings, people may stay back and not get too involved. I think what we might be able to learn from the rural settings is to realize that people can do a lot with very little, and inspire people and encourage people to take the initiative to take care of themselves and their own communities.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. We're here to the end of the time. I want to thank our guest, Courtney Flint. She's professor in the Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the U of I. Thanks very much.
Oh, thanks. It's been a pleasure.